And there were just nine of them live in the studio on Monday. Tremendous singing from Tenebrae under Nigel Short, that setting of the Nunc Dimittis by Holst. They'll be performing at Gloucester Cathedral on Saturday with the fabulous Sarah Connolly, all in aid of the Ivor Gurney Winder, whole day of celebration, marking that remarkable songster. We'll have the tune Friday Salon tomorrow. Isabella Feist, Christian Bezedenhout, Anna Maria Martinez singing, Derek Paravicini with his jazz quartet, and Imogen Cooper playing live for us on the piano. Don't miss it. Usual time, 4:30. But now, with the time at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, it's time to go live to this evening's proms.
Thank you very much, Sean. And welcome to this concert, given at the 2013 season of proms by the Philharmonia Orchestra. They're appearing tonight with their principal conductor and artistic director, the Finnish conductor and composer, Esa-Pekka Salonen. He and the orchestra are going to be joined on stage here in the Royal Albert Hall by the legend of the violin known by the single name of Midori, to give the first performance in this country of Peter Erdős's second violin concerto, which is called Do Re Mi. From the simplicity which that title suggests, we'll be transported to one of the richest and most highly coloured musical landscapes of the 19th century, with a performance, after the interval, of Anton Bruckner's monumental tribute to his idol Richard Wagner in his Seventh Symphony. But the Philharmonia begin their concert at the opposite end of the scale in every way, with the brief, bright and breezy overture to Mozart's comic opera Der Schauspieldirektor, The Impresario. This little divertissement was a late 18th century musical noises off, which Mozart dashed off to please the Emperor Joseph II in 1786. It takes the back off a theatre of Mozart's day to show the trials and tribulations of an impresario, Herr Frank, trying to put on an opera and having to cope with the jealous tantrums and overblown egos of a pair of rival prima donnas, Madame Herz and Madame Silberklang, scratching each other's eyes out. I imagine this must have been a case of life imitating art for Mozart, since he put on his Singspiel as part of a special evening in the Orangery at Schönbrunn Palace. He was allocated the German libretto of Der Schauspieldirektor to stage at one end, while at the other, his great rival, Joseph II's court composer Antonio Salieri, was given an Italian libretto to set Prima la musica, poi le parole, first the music, then the words, which also dealt with backstage machinations. I bet a good few sparks flew in the process, especially since the whole thing was done in a tearing hurry. The applause you heard there for the leader of the Philharmonia Orchestra, Andrew Haverton, who is already in his place. And here now to conduct them in the effervescent overture to Mozart's Der Schauspieldirektor is Esa-Pekka Salonen. Thank you. Esa-Pekka Salonen conducted the Philharmonia Orchestra in the overture to Mozart's comic Singspiel, Der Schauspieldirektor, The Impresario. Mozart's little opera, performed along with Salieri's as an after-dinner entertainment for the Emperor in 1786. And if you're trying to figure out what the connection is between all the pieces in this concert, don't bother. The reason it's there is because that's one of the first pieces Esa-Pekka Salonen ever conducted, and this is the first chance he's had to program it. Well, what we're about to hear now is the first performance in this country of a new work, a violin concerto by the Hungarian composer Peter Erdvös, first heard in Los Angeles this January. The piece was written for the virtuoso violinist we're going to hear play it in a couple of minutes, who goes by the name of Midori, and its title is a play on her name, Do-Re-Mi. If you're familiar with Peter Erdvös's music, you'll know he has a wry and quirky sense of fun. He wrote a fantastical electric piano concerto for Pierre-Laurent Aimard a few years ago, and in his operatic version of Three Sisters, Chekhov's three heroines are sung by a trio of countertenors. The conductor is Esa-Pekka Salonen.
It's a delightful piece, absolutely delightful piece. Playful without being shallow or superficial. Of course, Peter is a very experienced conductor and a musician, and he knows exactly what to do. And somehow he pushes everybody to their limits, not beyond, but to the very place where exciting things happen.
The first three notes of a C major scale are very basic, very fundamental scale that we have in our Western music. It's C, D, E. It's Do, Re, Mi. And he starts the concerto with the three notes. And in fact, the entire piece is pretty much based on these three pitches and how he actually expands from there. The character of the piece itself is very strong. It's sometimes anxious, sometimes brilliant, very exciting.
Tonight's soloist, the violinist Midori. Well, Peter Erdvös says in this work he liked the idea of going back to where he'd started as a youngster, putting voices together like building blocks and enjoying the pleasure of making variations in the patterns. He's particularly interested, he says, in the note re, wedged between do and mi and seeming to want to escape from the pressure of the other two sounds. He's made the note re lean microtonally towards the other two notes to create, he says, immense tension. The theme of the piece, he says, is simple things. He sets the soloist against a small string section with full wind and brass, and he keeps a trio of percussionists pretty fully occupied. And it is precisely the trio of percussionists that we seem to be missing at the moment. At least we have one, but the other two seem to be errant. I hope somebody has gone in search of them. The piece begins in a way that I think must make it unique, with a trio of triangles. And the composer, Peter Erdvös, said that he wanted the percussionists to hold the triangles up so everyone can see them. Well, with a bit of luck, we will see the triangles when their performers have been located. Midori has just made two appearances at the Edinburgh International Festival, a live Queen's Hall recital, which you may have heard on Radio 3 last week, in which she played some fabulous Bach. I was lucky enough to be there. And a work alongside the Bach by Alfred Schnittke, in memory of Dmitri Shostakovich, in which she played with a pre-recorded track of herself. And then she gave a second recital at the Queen's Hall last Saturday. I should tell you, it may not be instantly apparent, but the soloist part in Do-Re-Mi is very lightly amplified. Well, I think you can probably tell there's now rather an expectant buzz in a very packed Albert Hall as a couple of people have gone off to drag the percussionists from the pub or wherever it is they've secreted themselves. There is one valiant percussionist here pacing anxiously up and down, possibly contemplating the possibility of trying to play three triangles at once. That's a feat, I think, never before attempted on live radio. Well, a member of the woodwind section, who may have had some inkling as to where they may have gone, has returned to the platform, but there's still no sign of our two friends. Apparently, they really have seriously disappeared. Do, Re, and Mi, as we will now have to call them, are missing, presumed lost. Towards the end, I mean, as you'll hear, this is a piece with, in effect, a kind of high wire act for the violin. It's extremely athletic. And rather charmingly, when I was speaking to Midori earlier, she was saying, this is a really difficult piece to play. It's really challenging. And when I said, you know, and you're saying that, she completely nonplussed and said, oh, I don't know what you mean by that. Charmingly modest of her. But towards the end, there's an amazing, fantastically, technically difficult cadenza, supported by a drone from the violas. Well, a much deserved round of roaring and applause for the two missing percussionists now joining their fellow on stage. They now all three have triangles in hand, and so any moment now you will hear the ravishing beginning of Do Re Mi by Peter Ertwisch. And now here comes Midori, the soloist, with Esa-Pekka Salonen to perform for the first time in this country Do Re Mi, the second violin concerto by Peter Ertwisch. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've just heard Midori as the soloist with the Philharmonia Orchestra and their music director Esa-Pekka Salonen in the first UK performance of Do Re Mi, otherwise the Violin Concerto No. 2 by the 69-year-old Hungarian composer Peter Erzvers. You heard it live from the Royal Albert Hall on BBC Radio 3, a home of the Proms. And a spotlight picking out Peter Erzvers, standing in his seat just to my right here, applauding soloist and orchestra, and indeed conductor. Everybody I spoke to in the orchestra said that they found that piece enormous fun to play, teeming, as I'm sure you noticed, with quotations. You probably spotted more than I did, but you can't have missed the stabbing violins from the shower scene in Psycho, and maybe you spotted a treating of the woodbird from Wagner's Siegfried. I'm sure you also spotted that the bleeping watch isn't in Peter Erzvers' score, marking the passage of 8 o'clock. I should perhaps just say the wonderfully duetting principal viola was Andrei Vitovich. Midori returning to the stage. She's of course collected many, many bouquets for her performances, but she's also collected a number of awards for her role as educator and community activist, very much engaged in getting young people involved in music. And last year, she received the Crystal Award from the World Economic Forum in Davos. Her full name, Midori Goto, and the instrument she plays is a Guarneri made in 1734, which was once owned by Bronislaw Huberman. Soloist, orchestra, conductor, all on their feet, and another call for Peter Erzvers, standing, holding his hands in triumph above his head, but rather gallantly passing the applause back to the platform. He and the conductor had a little chat at the end of the rehearsal, and Esa-Pekka Salonen had turned to the Philharmonia and told them, "We have here a very happy composer." Well, it was the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra which first introduced an audience to the Mighty Symphony, which is the one work we're going to hear in the second half of this concert as we move into the misty, melancholy world of Anton Bruckner's great tribute to Richard Wagner, his Seventh Symphony, with its orchestration permeated by the sound of four Wagner tubas. Our interval this evening was recorded earlier on just across the road in the Royal College of Music. It's introduced by Petrok Trelawney.
Welcome to Proms Plus, where joining me to discuss tonight's programme are Mark van der Wiel, principal clarinetist in the Philharmonia Orchestra, and the writer, critic and presenter of Radio 3's Discovering Music, Stephen Johnson. Welcome to you both. Stephen, the premiere of the Seventh Symphony was one of the greatest successes in Bruckner's life, but in the years before, he'd had a pretty torrid time.
It's a rather depressing story in a lot of ways. Bruckner went to Vienna on advice in his early 40s because he was starting to make a name for himself in his native Linz in Upper Austria. And he was told to go to the great city of Schubert and Beethoven and Haydn and Mozart. There he would make a great name for himself. And he arrived in Vienna and was promptly ignored by everybody. He did have some success as an organist. In fact, he even came over to the Albert Hall to give a recital at one stage. He was a truly extraordinary improviser, apparently. But his music was regarded with, well, something close to contempt. The first performance of the Third Symphony was a disaster. It ended up with most of the audience walking out. And then when Bruckner turned around to acknowledge the applause of the few who were left, the orchestra got up and walked off the platform and left him on his own. This is the interesting thing, because Bruckner is often said to have lacked confidence as a man, which in some respects he does seem to be remarkably keen to placate people, ready to take advice. But the fact that he went on composing after that and went on composing symphonies suggests that at a very deep level he must have had a pretty strong certainty of what it was that he had to do.
It didn't help that he got on the wrong side of Vienna's leading critic.
Oh, Eduard Hanslick, yes. But I think we tend to forget how conservative Vienna was in those days. I remember talking to a German musician some years ago who said ruefully, "Well, they persecuted, they mocked Mahler and Bruckner, they ignored Schoenberg and the late Beethoven, and they don't even know where Mozart's buried." which is interesting. They did seem at the time to be much more interested in Johann Strauss than anything particularly sensitive. And there was a very strong feeling against Wagner in Vienna at the time, apart from a small band of determined progressives. And Bruckner had made the probably tactical mistake of dedicating his Third Symphony to Wagner, and that damned him probably before a note was heard.
Well, we'll talk in a moment about Wagner's influence on the Seventh Symphony, which is substantial. Mark, this is one of the earliest pieces of classical music, the Seventh Symphony, that you came to know.
Yes, that's true. We had a small collection of LPs at home, and one of my father's favourite LPs was the Bruckner Seventh Symphony, and we played it again and again and again, so I've known it right from a young age and have loved it all my life, really. Robin O'Neill, the bassoonist, and I will be sitting together playing this piece tonight. We played the same piece in the same hall with the European Youth Orchestra many years ago. With this piece, there aren't particular technical difficulties. The difficulty, for me, is performing a piece well and accurately, which moves me so much. You have to actually consciously step back from enjoying it oneself. There's a bit just before the end of the first movement, which is so moving with cellos and winds in canon, that I have to consciously concentrate on breath speed, breathing, fingering, in order that I don't drift away into a dream with the music rather than playing it.
I think I know the passage you mean. Is it where the timpani come in for the first time?
Yes.
That is
yes.
A magical moment.
Yes.
And it's one of those Bruckner things that's so important. One of the things that Bruckner does, which some people adore and other people find intensely frustrating, is that he'll set up expectations, then he'll keep you waiting for the moment when they're finally fulfilled. But if you have the confidence that he's going to do that, and you just enjoy it and relax and kind of breathe when he suddenly seems to be building up a climax and then stops, when you do get to that moment, the one you're describing, where the timpani enter for the first time and this motif climbs through the orchestra with the echoes on the clarinets and the oboes, it is incredibly moving, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm feeling
yes.
moved even just thinking about it.
Let's talk through the shape of the symphony. The story goes that the opening melody came to Bruckner in a dream.
Yes. I mean, this is a very moving story, given that at this stage in his career, there was some signs of beginnings of interest in his music amongst people who really knew what they were doing, like the conductor Hans Richter, for instance. But still, Bruckner was not a name as a composer at all, and at least not in Vienna. And a school friend, or rather, I beg your pardon, a friend from his youth, a conductor called Ignaz Dorn, who had died much earlier, came to Bruckner in a dream, apparently, and played the opening theme of the symphony to him on a viola and said, "This will bring you success," so the story goes. If it's true, it's extraordinary, because it was the turning point in Bruckner's career. But interestingly for Bruckner, the first performance didn't happen in Vienna, where everyone was still largely set against him, but in Leipzig, which was a much, much more adventurous, intellectually curious place musically, partly because of the legacy of Liszt, who'd worked there for a long time. And it was an amazing success. And I think one critic said, "I have to admit, I don't think I've ever seen a composer call to the platform five or six times after each movement of a symphony." So you can imagine the effect of this on Bruckner. And yet it's extraordinary because the symphony, so much of the symphony has a serenity, which I wouldn't say is new in Bruckner, but it is something that you feel is almost, you'd expect him to write this after the success, not before it. It's extraordinary.
Let's hear that first movement opening and the theme that came in the dream. You call that theme a gift of nature in your programme note tonight.
Yes, I think the word visionary is used far too much these days, but I think that's one case where I would say it was very apt, absolutely to the point. It really does seem to have come from somewhere other than the composer's own calculating mind. In fact, one friend of Bruckner's remarked that Bruckner had a fascinatingly sophisticated attitude to composing. He's often described as a rather naive composer who sleepwalked through composition. This is absolute nonsense. He calculated the structures of his movements very carefully, almost like a medieval architect designing a cathedral. But the friend who had observed the composition of this symphony said that this was quite different. This just came straight out onto the paper. And you can feel that it had that kind of quality of being given to him, almost. You can see why he thought it was God. He was a devout Roman Catholic, Bruckner, and felt that God had sustained him through many a trial and that this theme was one of the proofs of that.
He idolised Wagner to an extent that Wagner became a little embarrassed about his appreciation.
Yes, imagine Wagner being embarrassed by being praised. This is a very strange thing because lots of composers imitated Wagner. But in Bruckner's case, I think it was more of there being an affinity on a certain level. When Bruckner heard Wagner for the first time, I think he recognized it something that was already in himself. This sense of great space that you get in Bruckner's music, he's already moving in that direction before he discovers Wagner, largely because of his huge debt to Schubert and to some of Schubert's more spacious works. And that lovely sense you get with Schubert sometimes of him setting up a kind of hypnotic, mesmeric or meditative pace in a movement, often you'll find the same rhythm repeated over and over again with the tune on the top, which is very, very much a Bruckner kind of thing as well. But that combination of the sense of defying the movement of time that you sometimes get with Wagner, combined with this very sensuous kind of mysticism, which as Bruckner as a Catholic would be maybe more in tune with, this all, I think, spoke to him on a very deep level. How much he understood Wagner and what Wagner was about is a matter for intense debate, and there have been all sorts of speculations on this, but maybe it was a case of creative misunderstanding in some respects. But he clearly did find a kindred spirit in Wagner in some respects.
And yes. They met. How close did they become?
Oh, well, there's a lovely story about Bruckner taking the manuscripts of the Second and Third Symphonies to Wagner to see if Wagner would accept the dedication. And Wagner said, yes, yes, another symphony wanted to dedicate it to me. Yes, yes, you know, leave it there. Bruckner goes back at the appointed time and finds Wagner playing the opening theme of the Third Symphony. He says, this is very good. This is really very good. You know, come in, have a drink. And Bruckner gets so intoxicated in both senses with Wagner's company and with the beer that he's given that the next day he can't remember which symphony it was that Wagner agreed to accept the dedication. So he sends a nervous little telegram to Wagner saying, which one was it? Was it the one with the trumpet? Yes, 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 says Wagner. They met on several occasions. Bruckner was absolutely moved to piece to bits by Parsifal. The mysticism, again, you can imagine in speaking something very deep in Bruckner. And afterwards, he almost said, Master, he fell before Wagner's feet and said, Master, I pray to you. At which point, Wagner said, no, no, enough of this, Bruckner, good night, and swept out of the room. But Bruckner was always, interestingly enough, looking for father figures. And sometimes his own father had died when he was very young. And interestingly enough, one of the conductor he called my father in art, mein künstlicher Vater, was actually 15 years younger than him. So, you know, all the time he was looking for figures, male figures particularly, that he could attach himself to. And Wagner certainly fulfilled this function.
Do you see similarities in playing, Mark, this with Wagner's music?
As a player, I think in the emotional impact of the music, yes. In the writing for us, no. I would say it's very, very different. Wagner will use the woodwind far more soloistically, or far more often soloistically, whereas Bruckner will tend to use us sometimes as soloists, but often as a small choir. For example, you know, maybe a particular organ registration, or mixing us with other instruments. Mm. Now, the musical example that you already heard from the very opening of the symphony, you wouldn't hear that music and think clarinet. But we're in there, and the clarinet is mixed with the cellos and the violas to make a new tone, a new sound, which is exactly the sound that Bruckner wanted to convey that particular emotion. So although you don't hear us in the symphony all the time as soloists, we're part of the colour. And if you love the music as I do, that's immensely satisfying to play.
At the beginning of the second movement, Bruckner uses Wagner's own instrument, the Wagner tubas at the beginning. And I want to know what a Wagner tuba is, but let's hear them playing at the beginning of the second movement first.
If you're watching as well as listening, if you're at the concert tonight, at the end of the first movement, you'll notice Peter Smith, our tuba player, will walk from his normal position next to the trombones over to sit with the Wagner tubas for the second movement and then walk back again. Because the bass notes that you heard so richly just then are provided by the real bass tuba underneath the four Wagner tubas. And so Esa-Pekka Salonen has asked him to sit with them for that movement and then go back in his normal place for the other movements where he works with the trombones. And that richness of sound of those five players playing together is absolutely extraordinary. Now, I'm sure you'll all be in very good positions in the concert, but I can tell you, for that particular passage, the clarinets have the best seat in the house.
And deservedly so. What is a Wagner tuba?
The technical term is a sax horn, but they're somewhere like something between a horn and a tuba. If you've ever seen a Bavarian umpire band with those funny instruments with the big bent bells at the top, they're almost the same instrument, but played with a different mouthpiece, which I'm told is crucial. They've got a bit of a formidable reputation amongst players. One player I met from the CBSO, City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, described them as catastrophones because all the horn's ability to be unpredictable is magnified by about 10. But they do make a wonderful sound. One thing, of course, they have the same sort of range as the tenor and bass trombones. But one thing they can do much more easily than trombones is play legato, very smooth melodies, like horns, because they have valves, not the slide. So you don't get the slide between notes if you do it all in one breath. And they also have a wonderful effect. You may have got a sense of that in that passage, but a little later in the slow movement, when they come in for the first time on their own, after a wonderful solo of Mark, by the way.
Mark's crossing his fingers.
They come in very quietly. Some of the best moments with the Wagner tubas are very quiet. And there's an effect, like, you know, some kinds of organ pipe, where you hear the air go into the pipe a split second before the note takes, a sort of doo. They have that quality, and a friend of mine described it as being like biting into a ripe peach. It has just that, oh. And the harmonies they play there are quite gorgeous, too.
There is a sense of mourning in the second movement. Is it true that news came to Bruckner of Wagner's death as he was writing it?
I haven't been able to work out the chronology of this exactly, partly because we don't know where Bruckner was with the compositional sketching of this when the news reached him. But there is no doubt that by the end of the movement, where the Wagner tubas have a wonderful elegy with the bass tuba, it's the great moment in that movement, that the news of Wagner's death had reached him. And interestingly enough, the phrase that they play is very, very similar to, in fact, it's identical at certain points, with a phrase in a contemporary work, Bruckner's setting of the Te Deum. And it's associated with the words non confunda in aeternum, let me never be confounded. In other words, I put my trust in you, O Lord. It's a it's a phrase that's also repeated in the context of the Requiem Mass. So there is an idea of commemoration of the dead here and the prayer for the soul, the repose of the soul.
We get that real sort of sense of Bruckner and that sort of rustic sound in the third movement, which is marked very fast, and there is a real drive to it, isn't
there? Yes, it is. In rehearsal, when you hear elements of the music on their own that perhaps you wouldn't normally hear on their own, when those accompaniment figures, which are repeated and repeated and repeated, it almost sounds like minimalist music. Yeah. The moment the melodies are there, it no longer does. Yeah. But it's interesting that that's maybe the way that Bruckner was building his music in blocks, in that way. You can listen to the scherzo as fast music, or you could listen to it in longer phrases, in which case it's perhaps not so fast. But it does have a real Viennese character and a rustic character, as you said, and a beautifully songful atmosphere in the trio section.
Let's, just as our last musical clip, hear the opening of the finale. It's surprisingly light, the finale, and short.
That's absolutely true. And Esa-Pekka particularly asked us to make parts of that movement sound athletic, was the word he used. He also was commenting on the little musical example that you just heard. The finale of the symphony, like the first movement, begins with a tremolo, although in the finale you only hear it on its own for a very, very short moment before the melody comes in. But he said he'd always thought of the beginning of the finale as you would open a window and life was there. Mm. So he said it's not a mysterious opening, it's a springing to life.
Mm. We've run out of time, I'm afraid. Mark van der Wiel and Stephen Johnson, thank you both very much indeed.
And thank you to Petrarch Trelawney, who was talking to the writer and broadcaster, Stephen Johnson, and the Philharmonia's first clarinetist, Mark van der Wiel, in that Proms Plus event. Welcome back to this prom from the Royal Albert Hall, live on BBC Radio 3, the home of the proms. It's given by the Philharmonia Orchestra and their music director, Esa-Pekka Salonen. There's just one work in this part of their programme, Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. In talking and writing about Bruckner's symphonies, we often come up with images of massive architecture, cathedrals of sound, or of oceans or alpine landscapes. When I spoke to Esa-Pekka Salonen earlier, he came up with a very different, surprising image.
You know, Bruckner is a very paradoxical composer because we often use those words, architecture and vast landscapes and oceans and this and that. But there's also a child somewhere. And that I find absolutely fascinating. You know, when a toddler plays, he or she pulls out toys and puts them on the floor and then just very quickly gets started with it and then pulls out the next toy. And finally, as a parent, we all know, at the end of the day, the playroom is completely littered with all these kinds of things. And Bruckner somehow sometimes does the same, especially in his last movements, where he just pulls out things seemingly randomly out of his bottomless bag. And then our task, conductors and musicians alike, is to somehow create the glue that unifies these toys. And this is not meant to be any kind of disrespect, rather than it's more a sort of intuitive feeling I get sometimes. It's alive. It's not some kind of a dead object like a cathedral or a sort of a postcard alpine landscape. They're not very adequate metaphors for this.
The conductor is Pekka Salonen. The Seventh Symphony was the work which really made Bruckner's name as a composer and finally put an end to his years of neglect and even ridicule in Vienna. Bruckner liked to tell the story that the first broad theme you'll hear came to him in a dream. An old friend from his Linz days appeared to him, whistled the tune, and told him that with this theme you will make your fortune. Was something like a year into his work on this symphony, Bruckner heard rumours that Wagner had gone to Venice for the sake of his health. I thought to myself that the master cannot live much longer. It was then that the music for the Adagio of the symphony came into my head. To make his tribute unmistakable, Bruckner gives the music a distinctive Wagnerian sonority, introducing a quartet of Wagner tubas, the instrument Wagner had invented to give a darker, burnished, more solemn coloration, somewhere between a French horn and a euphonium. The movement which follows is one of Bruckner's great whirling scherzos, with a sense of driving, cumulative power. It's dominated by a clarion trumpet call. In the finale, the Wagner tubas make another appearance, making a subtle allusion to the Valhalla motif from The Rheingold. Andrew Halloran has taken his place in the leader's seat. And now, Esa-Pekka Salonen joins the Philharmonic Orchestra to conduct Bruckner's Symphony No. 7. Thank you.
Thank you. The music which turned the tide for Anton Bruckner on the 31st of December 1884. His Symphony No. 7, which we've just heard in a performance live from the BBC Proms, given by the Philharmonia Orchestra leader Andrew Haveron, conducted by their music director Esa-Pekka Salonen. He said that he never feels that conducting Bruckner takes any energy out of him, rather the reverse. "I feel very close to this music," he said. "I have done since I was a kid. It's like riding on a wave." And he's certainly taken this Albert Hall audience with him on that journey. Here he comes once again. Getting to their feet, the quartet of Wagner tubas, played this evening by Jeffrey Bryant, James Handy, Alex Edmondson and Thomas Kane, notoriously intractable beasts which one CABSO player refers to as catastrophones. But Esa-Pekka Salonen, so delighted by their performance at the end of the second movement, that he told them, "I'll make a provision in my will that you'll come to my funeral and play this. I'll enjoy it." The entire woodwind section standing there. And now the whole orchestra on its feet. More Bruckner next week on the penultimate night, when on Friday the Vienna Philharmonic will be here with Laurie Marzell to play Bruckner's 8th Symphony. In tomorrow night's prom, a Finnish strand to a programme which is a potted history of the tone poem, I guess. Sibelius's Popular's Daughter, alongside Bantok's The Witch of Atlas and Richard Strauss's Alsosprach Zarathustra. Vladimir Jurovsky will be conducting the London Philharmonic, and they'll be joined by the Serbian pianist Annika Vavic to play Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 3. But as Esa-Pekka Salonen returns, gets up on the podium with the whole orchestra standing around him, nothing left here but the sound of that applause. And with it, I'll return you for the rest of the Radio 3 evening to Ian Skelly in Broadcasting House.
Donald, thank you very much indeed. What a wonderful end to that concert, which began with Donald's valiant efforts to keep the show going whilst they searched for all those triangle players at the start of the concert. A classic moment on Radio 3. If you missed it, why not visit the Radio 3 website and find your way to the iPlayer radio to hear it and the rest of that marvellous concert again. And a fascinating Proms Plus event, if you missed it, hosted by Petrock Trelawney, with Stephen Johnson and a musician who played in that performance of the Bruckner by the Philharmonia Orchestra, the orchestra's first clarinetist, Mark van der Veel. It's all at the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3. Well, we're back at the Proms, as Donald said, tomorrow night, and also tomorrow afternoon, when you have a second chance to hear last Friday's Prom, which was given by the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra, Lutosławski's Concerto for Orchestra, Shostakovich's second piano concerto with the soloist Alexander Melnikov, and to end Shostakovich's 6th Symphony, and also music by Panufnik, a tragic overture and a lullaby. I was talking to a young chap who was at that prom, and he told me that he'd become a convert to Panufnik as a result. Well, if you don't know his music yourself, why not become one too by listening in from 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3.
Tone poems by Richard Strauss, Bantok and Sibelius, live from the BBC Proms. I'm Christopher Cook. Join me as Vladimir Jurovsky and the London Philharmonic Orchestra trace the development of one of music's most flexible and imaginative forms. Friday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Just gonna 20 to 10 now. A very good evening to you. This is Ian Skelly here with the music and the programmes for the rest of the night here on Radio 3. I do hope you'll stay tuned, not least because we're going to head to Durham in a while, where the Lindisfarne Gospels are paying a visit. The author David Armand had a look at the exhibition recently and was rather moved to explore what the Lindisfarne Gospels mean to his fellow Northeasterners. You can hear what he discovered in The Gospels Come Home tonight at 10 o'clock. And an hour later, you can hear the collaborative session between someone called Robin the Fog and Francisca Lance. Hear what they do in Late Junction tonight, together with urban underground sounds from Brazil and music produced by the legendary BBC Radiophonic Workshop. That's all from 11 o'clock in Late Junction tonight here on BBC Radio 3. Well, to take us there, first of all, music which will feature in our early music show this weekend, the music of Rameau. It featured in a recital given by Christophe Rousset at St Cecilia's Hall in Edinburgh recently. He was playing a harpsichord, which is a gem of the Hall's Museum of Historical Instruments, the Russell Collection. This is a short suite by Rameau.
Thank you.
Music by Rameau, played by Christophe Rousset on a harpsichord from the Russell Collection, housed in St. Cecilia's Hall in Edinburgh, which is the venue for that recent concert he gave. You can hear it in full on Saturday at lunchtime in the early music show at 1 o'clock here on Radio 3. Well, let's stay in Scotland a moment longer and hear from a Scottish violinist who's riding rather high in the classical music charts at the moment. This is Nicola Benedetti.
Thank you.
Nicola Benedetti with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra under Kirill Karabits playing My Edward and I from the film version of Jane Eyre with a score by Dario Marinelli. This is BBC Radio 3, it's 10 o'clock. And next tonight, the story of the Lindisfarne Gospels, one of the masterpieces of the early medieval world. For the last four centuries, they've resided in London, but this July, August and September, they've made their way back to the northeast for a major exhibition in Durham. The writer David Armand has long been intrigued by the Gospel book, which was created in honour of St Cuthbert. And for this programme, he explores how it was made and why it's so important to the identity of the northeast. Here he is with The Gospels Come Home.
Listen. Hear the water and the wind and the birds. This is Lindisfarne. We also call it Holy Island. It's an island in the cold North Sea. A place of beauty, a place with a great history, and a place where a great book was made.
The Lindisfarne Gospels is a gospel book. It's the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. But it's exquisite in so many ways. It's a work of art, so it's not just a book to worship from. But it's also not just a book. It's a story of the people who made it. And rather than the book being created from pigments from around the world, the pigments were actually produced much more locally. So it's not just created from the region, it's actually of the region.
The Gospels left Lindisfarne over 1,000 years ago. They started a series of journeys through space and time before ending up at the British Library, where they've been for the last four centuries. Now, for 3 months this summer, they're coming home again, not quite as far as Lindisfarne, but to Durham. I want to look at the history of this book and of the people and places associated with it. And I want to find out why they matter so much to the people of the Northeast. In Durham, there's already great excitement.
We've got somewhere in the region of 300 different activities that are happening across the whole region. So we have a sponsored cycle ride. We've had a writer in residence. We've got wonderful calligraphy exhibitions that are happening. But also we've got plays, we've got poetry. And the most exciting one from my point of view is that we're actually bringing together the Lindisfarne Gospels Community Choir and bringing 1,000 voices to sing on Palace Green on the day that we launched the project. On top of that, we've got Catherine Tickell, the folk musician, and also the Futureheads, which are a rock band from Sunderland. One piece that I just found out about that we're getting into Durham is a local church who's bringing the knitted gospels to Durham. From Berwick to Kirkleatham, we find that everybody's really excited about the gospels returning.
You can't just come to Lindisfarne whenever you like. You have to time your journey to this paradoxical place, which is only a proper island at high tide. You have to wait for the sea to retreat, for the tide to fall. Then the causeway for motorists and tourist coaches and cyclists is exposed, and the longer pilgrim's way across the sand, marked by a line of posts. I'm at the causeway now. The island's a couple of miles away. There's the little castle on its conical rock. There's a mackerel sky, a turning sea. The archipelago of the Farn stretches away towards the horizon. There's a couple of fishing boats. As always, there's the birds, swans, eider ducks known as cuddy ducks, kittiwakes, and skylarks, skylarks, skylarks. Halfway across each of these routes is a refuge hut, with a wooden stairway leading to it. They're provided for those who think they can defy the sea, or maybe for those who simply get distracted as they cross, by the beauty of the place, by the presence of so much history, so many spirits. It's in a far-flung corner of a far-flung place, 60 miles beyond Tyneside, where I was born. We used to come sometimes when I was a boy, on slow family car trips on the narrow Great North Road. Once we were very late, probably held up by the endless traffic jam through the heart of Alnwick. When we came to cross, the water was already running slowly over the causeway. Did we dare? My dad told us to keep our feet up, to hold our breath, and he drove into the rising sea. I was petrified. I thought we'd be engulfed. I imagined a wall of water roaring towards us to wash us and our little VW away. I was a Catholic boy, an altar boy, and a member of the Legion of Mary. I came on coach trips with the church. We used to splash about on the island's beaches, play Foley the Best in its dunes, eat hard-boiled eggs and bread and butter, throw crumbs to the gulls, kick our footballs, hoot at the seals that raised their heads from its waters, dare to swim in the icy sea, and then head home again, led in singing Faith of Our Fathers by one of our kind black-clothed priests at the front of the bus. Once, as our day was done, and we headed to the mainland, a priest, perhaps Father Strong, a man from Kildare, called and pointed. That's where they'd have walked, boys. Who? Someone asked. Oh, a bunch of monks, carrying a coffin with a saint inside it. Imagine it, boys, the monks with their hoods. Poor souls. They were leaving the island forevermore, probably terrified. We looked through the windows as the sea rose. Oh, and they had a precious book with them too. It was all 1,000 years ago. I'll tell you the story sometime. Now, boys, he said, how about another chorus of the faith? He never did tell us the whole story. As I grew older, I came to love this place for its beauty and its wildness, for the birds that flock around it, for the weird rising and falling of the sea, the glistening sands that appear and disappear, for the lovely changes of the light. And I learned the story of the monks and the saint and the precious book, a story that turns the tide, that tells of a different history, a different north. Like many northern writers, I've been driven to come to terms with this place, where one of the world's first great books was made, at a time when a great Northumbrian culture was at its height. So what kind of place was the island when the Gospels were created? I'm here in Durham with David Petz, who's a lecturer in archaeology at Durham University.
It was one of the most important monasteries of early medieval Northumbria. Most of the buildings in the early medieval period would have been wooden. The only building which was made from stone would have been the church. And even that, the first version of a church, wasn't made of stone. It was a wooden structure covered in lead plates. And it was only once Cuthbert had died and his relics had been turned into a site of pilgrimage that a new church was built out of stone. Anglo-Saxon monasteries were very different to medieval monasteries, the great medieval monasteries like the Revo and Fountains or here in Durham. They wouldn't have had formal cloisters. Instead, they would have had much smaller buildings. We know the monks had individual cells or huts. There was a guest house. There would have been farms. There would have been a cemetery.
And how many people would be living in the monastery?
At its height, there may have been 50, 100, maybe even more monks. But also, there would have been a wider community of people who weren't monks themselves but worked on the monks' land. There's references to women being on the island, peasants. So it would have been one of the biggest settlements in North Northumberland, probably.
So it was a pretty busy place at times, then?
I think it would have been pretty busy. You've got the monastery, you've got the palace at Bamborough, you've got other churches, other settlements in the surrounding area. This isn't a remote, backwards place. This is one of the core regions of early medieval Northumbria, one of the central areas.
I mean, this seems to be such a central point, is that the Gospels came from a place which was actually culturally and politically pretty important. It wasn't a far-flung corner.
No, absolutely. There's multiple palace sites. It's got good communications north and south. And, of course, once if you sail due east, you're not that far from getting off into Scandinavia and northern Germany, Denmark. So, again, there's crisscrossing routes. And finally, if you head west, particularly going along the Tweed Valley, you're getting over to the western side of the country. Got the big important kingdom of Dalriada in western Scotland, where the Northumbrian king Oswald spent some time before coming back to Northumbria. And he was the king who actually founded Lindisfarne using monks he met when he was over in exile in western Scotland.
So this age when Lindisfarne was so important, when the monastery was so powerful, when it had this rich culture around it, when it drew on influences from so far afield, how long did this last?
Well, the monastery is founded in 635, and they face the first Viking raids at the end of the 8th century. And they stay there in the face of Viking raiding for around another 100 years. So we're talking about 250 years. And certainly once the cult of Cuthbert became important, and that would have really acted to draw people. It was, you know, one of the most important and powerful monasteries in the north of England.
So this was the world in which this book was created. But who made it? How was it made and why? I'm in the Bishop Cousins Library in Durham now with the distinguished historian of the book, Richard Gameson. And in front of us is a facsimile of the Lindisfarne Gospels.
Actually, who made the Lindisfarne Gospels is a question we can answer fairly accurately. Eadfrith, Bishop of Lindisfarne, because we have a memorandum that was added to the book in the 10th century. And because we know something of the dates of Eadfrith, we know he died in 722, that gives us an upper limit for the creation of the book as a whole.
So is this unusual that a work like this would be made by one person? Because some books were often made by teams.
By teams. Yes, in this instance, one man is responsible for almost all the script and almost all the decoration, and the homogeneity of style confirms that to be the case. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean it is just the work of one man, because behind him there is the involvement of a team of the community as a whole, because someone is making the parchment, someone is procuring the ink.
It's just such a lovely process, you know, because they take skins from the animals, they take the quills from the birds, they take dyes from the plants. It's almost like the island and the people who lived on it achieved this great, great work of art.
Yes, it's linked into the soil and the resources that are available on the island. So we know that at least 130 calves were used to make the pages alone. As you say, the standard pen is a trimmed feather from a large bird, like a goose, for instance. It would take about 2 years for the pen to get to an appropriate stage when you can use it, so they're preparing for this. And equally, another thing to bear in mind is that if you are right-handed, you need the wing feather from a left wing, and left-handed from a right wing. So there's an awful lot of birds flying around in circles, given that one wing has been plucked and not the other. And then in terms of the basic materials, the ink they can make locally, part of it is carbon-based ink, other bits are from hawthorn or from oak galls. Whereas the pigments, they're almost certainly relying on resources that they are getting from elsewhere, not necessarily from exotic locations, but a classic colour in the book is a very bright yellow, which is orpiment, and we don't know exactly where the sources were for that, but possibly the Lake District. So it also begins to tell us something about Lindisfarne's connections with a broader trading network.
And some of the influences on the book come from, I mean, thousands of miles away, don't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, for instance, the text. We know because of characteristics in this text that its exemplar, its ultimate exemplar, came from Italy, and he turns it, Eadfrith turns it, into a more Irish type of script. And we know that the exemplar was written without spaces between the letters and the words. Eadfrith copies the text exactly, but he puts spaces between the words. And if one were to highlight Ireland's greatest ever contribution to world civilization, it would be the idea of putting spaces between the words.
We've talked about how the island provides the materials for the book and draws from the birds, from the beasts, from the land itself. One of the things that fascinates me is that it's actually inside the body of the work itself. So we see lots of bird life inside these images.
Indeed. Full pages of decoration, often called carpet pages because they resemble elaborate patterned carpets, precede each of the Gospels. And although their overall structure is a cross, between the arms of the cross and in the interstices is a rich tapestry of interlocking, interlacing birds. And if one looks closely at these birds, you can see deliberate references to the shags and the cormorants that one sees, of course, aplenty around Lindisfarne. Now, they aren't depictions of those particular birds. They take elements from them, their beaks, and weave them into a coloured tapestry.
That seems to be very important, that Eadfrith will take letters and words and transform them into artwork. And he's saying something about... What's he talking about? He's saying something about the importance of the words themselves and the kind of higher meaning?
Yep. He is elevating words, written communication, into beautiful visual symbols that help you to raise your mind to the divine. And the act, the time, the care of producing such an object of beauty is a devotional act in itself. Now, not Eadfrith, but some early medieval scribes wrote comments on the work that they were doing, and they often stressed how tiring it was. But the point here as well is showing that it's a discipline, that you are giving of yourself, that you are suffering in order to create something that is worthy and spiritual. We should also remember you would only work on a book like this in optimum light conditions. Now, I know we've both been on Lindisfarne in less than clement weather, and there must have been many occasions when simply the light conditions were not adequate, and you would wait for another day. You wouldn't plough on regardless. You wouldn't work by candlelight.
You used a beautiful phrase just a couple of minutes ago, the end of the writing season.
Well, by the time you get to autumn, is it realistic to keep going, given low lighting levels and the greater cold that will affect the steadiness of your hand?
I mean, I work in a shed in Northumberland sometimes.
But do you have electric light?
I have electric light, but it's. I understand the writing season in terms of the cold.
Yes.
Night falls like the sea rises, isolating us here on the island. There's darkness over the sea and clusters of stars above. The lighthouse light of Longstone out on the Farns sweeps across the sea again, again. Far to the south there's a glow of gold above Tyneside. A few lights twinkle on the mainland out across the disappeared causeway. Bats flicker and owls screech and hoot. Always the sea, whispering, moving. I think of the seals on their rocks, the puffins on their rocky nests, and the Northumbrian breeze and the sand and marram grass. Most travellers leave for the night. They leave on the last low tide. There's a real excitement in staying on and being one of the island's shadows. All writers need the writers who have gone before. All art is passed down through time. I move a black felt tip across a blank white page below a reading lamp, and I think of Eadfrith. It's May, it's coming towards the height of the writing season. He's been all day at his task, putting the words into beautiful straight lines, one word then another, one line then another, one chapter then another, and the moments of spectacular illumination, done for God and for Cuthbert and for all the saints. Cassiodorus said that the work of the scribe was sacred. Happy his design, praiseworthy his zeal, to preach with the hand alone, to unleash tongues with the fingers, to give salvation silently to mortals. Every word of the Lord written by the scribe is a wound inflicted on Satan. Me, I don't believe in a heaven or a hell that can be affected by our words, but I do believe that each word written is an act of optimism, an act of creation, a move against the forces of destruction. Our stories and poems and songs, all of our arts help to recreate the world. The words move across the page like footsteps across the sand. They flow like water, the lines gather like a tide. These writers and artists from Northumbria's past can nourish all of us. We want to write with the diligence of Bede, to sing with the sudden freedom of Cadman, to make our books as beautiful as Eadfrith did. I love the earthiness of these gospels. They have the marks of ancient fingers and thumbs on them. I rub my thumb across the page I'm writing. I rub some dust alongside the felt-tipped words. It's dark outside. It's late. Maybe now Eadfrith would be rising, not to write, but to chant prayers in the middle of the night. I'll listen to the owls and watch the flash of the lighthouse light as it sweeps past. I'll look out at the endless burning stars and endless darkness. I'll think of the book's return. So at the moment, the Gospels haven't yet begun their journey. So we've come down to the British Library in London, where they are now. And I'm speaking to Deborah Novotny, who's head of collection care. And we're sitting in the conservation studio. So how have they managed to last this long?
They've lasted this long because they've been extremely well looked after. And it's incredible, really, when you think of the size of the volume, that it is still in that superb condition. I think what's interesting for me is the size of the volume and the weight, which it's about 20 pounds or just over 8 kilos, which is the equivalent, if you like, of a tyre from a car.
That's amazing. I had no idea it was so heavy. Is that, I assume, because of the nature of the materials that we used in making it?
Well, it was parchment. It has been rebound. It's not in its original binding. The binding it's currently in is mid-Victorian. It's got quite a lot of metal on the edges, which would add to the weight. And obviously there would be a certain amount of weight with the pigments that have been used.
And the pigments, one of the things about looking at the Gospels is how fresh everything still looks. The colours are so bright.
That's because most of the time the volume has been closed, but I think it's testament to the craftsmanship of the people who made the Gospels at the time.
So here we are at last in front of the Lindisfarne Gospels, displayed in a case in the Treasures Gallery of the British Library. And I'm with Scott McKendrick, who is Head of History and Classics. Scott, could you tell us how, all through its history, it's been recognised by whoever had it or was associated with it? They recognised how important it was, how unique it was.
I think this book has been recognised for different reasons at different times. You might be surprised to hear that probably in the middle of the 16th century, it was most prized for the early English translation in it rather than the art. And obviously, if you go right the way back, the context of it is that it's created in honour of St. Cuthbert. It's something that I think people, when they see it, in a sense, you know, you cannot but respond to the quality of the work. The immediacy of it is quite... A lot of people don't believe that it was written 1,300 years ago.
Yeah, that todayness, well, you know, standing here looking at the pages, they're so white and the ink is so clear. Even the gloss, which was put on a couple of hundred years later,
yes, yeah,
is still very fresh. Yeah. And one of the things that really fascinates me about it is that gloss. It's the first translation.
You have to slightly nuance that. It's not a translation in our sense, where you have the start of the sentence and the end of the sentence. What you literally have is the translation of each word. So you have the Latin word on one line, and above that you have in small characters the Old English word. So you can't run those words together to form an Old English sentence, but they're prompts so that you look at the Latin and you thought, oh, I don't know what that means. And there it gives you the...
Oh, that's
it's a sort of crib, in a way.
Wonderful. And put in by the hand of someone at Chesterley Street?
Yes.
Aldred,
who was then priest, and he became a provost of the community. So we're talking about the middle of the 10th century at that point. And this helps us track the passage of the book. And this is where it comes very murky. We know pretty certainly that it was at Lindisfarne. It almost certainly moves once the Vikings have really taken over. I mean, they have that shock attack in, what, 793. Then a century later, the community decides it's just too challenging. So they move, and then they end up in Chesterley Street, and then, of course, they'll move subsequently to Durham.
It's wonderful because lots of people travel up and down the A1, or they get the train to Newcastle or right. to Edinburgh. They pass by Chesterley Street.
Right.
And it's just this little town beside the A1, beside
yes.
the Great North Railway. But it was so important. It was such a crucial thing in human history.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I mean, the Lindisfarne itself, where people often just pass it to see it off the coast and don't recognise that it was one of the great centres of the early medieval world, not just in the perspective of this country, but within the perspective of Europe. It was a major, major centre.
Yeah.
Few decades to either side of, say, the year 700, this is literally a golden age of the production of art in England, but particularly in Northumbria. The books, the metalwork, the jewellery, the stonework, this is what Lindisfarne is part of.
As children, we were told that this island was an important place, that it was a holy place, but we never really knew why. We were never really told that one of our first great writers, Bede, lived and wrote in Jarrow, near the mouth of the Tyne, not 2 miles away from where we went to school. That one of the world's great centres of learning had existed just down the coast at the mouth of the Weir. There was nothing about Eadfrith. Yes, Northumberland had an interesting past, but battles and bloodshed were the things we knew. Border reavers rustling cattle and slaughtering each other, Picts howling as they uselessly attacked the Roman wall. We were Roman Catholics. The important place was Rome, the middle of the world. All roads led to it. All faith grew from it. All instruction issued from it. We knew the book was important, but it was kept in London. And we were northern, and the north was insignificant. London was significant, but this place of filthy rivers lined with shipyards, of closing coal mines and fading industry, famous for its Jarrow March, its much-loved but unsuccessful football teams, for its toughness, its bluff-friendliness, its scarily coarse tongue, its huge empty spaces stretching north from Tyneside into a distant northern Hayes. This had always been at the far fringe of the civilised world, hadn't it? The Romans had even built a wall here to mark the limits of the civilised. This was where we lived, where civilization petered out and wilderness began. I always wrote from an early age, "What are you going to write about? And you're not going to use that accent, are you?" I tried not to write about the North. I wasn't going to be a Northern writer. To be a Northern writer meant to be funny, to be nostalgic, to be parochial, to speak only to those who speak like you. When I first went to Rome as a hitchhiking student, I loved the place for its heat and its energy, but I hated the pomp and power expressed in its great stones. I hated the stony vastness of St. Peter's Square. I hated the gleaming vestments, the velvet slippers, the ranks of cardinals and bishops. I continued to dislike it, its gross monumentality, the pompous assumption of power, the stench of wealth, the never-ending undercurrent of corruption. Could an Eadfrith have survived in such a place? Could a Bede? Could a Cuthbert? No. And could a cardinal or a pope have existed upon Lindisfarne? No. Not without ruining it. Not without building ghastly churches filled with garish art, paving the place with stone, scattering the skylarks, scaring the seals, turning the mind away from the sound of air and water and birdsong. It's another amazing morning here on Holy Island. The sun's shining, the sea's still, the air's still, the flowers are blooming, the swallows are flying back. And I'm in the grounds of the Priory with Ryan Douglas, who was born and grew up here on this island. So is this what it's always like here?
It is a fantastic morning, isn't it? I mean, the sun is really rather warm. We do get this throughout the summer, but the winter is dramatic. If we get snow, we often get sea ice, which washes onto the causeway. We get howling northerly winds that batter our houses. But we do get these lovely days as well. The grey seals have just popped on the Farne Islands and they're starting to appear on the sandal beds. We'll have about 2,000 seals here just now. And when you get up in the morning, you can hear them howling away. It's very eerie when you come down to open the Priory and you've got these seals howling in the background. A lot of people think it's ghosts. They didn't think seals make those noises. So yeah, the swallows are just arriving. As we came up with the winter, we said goodbye to the greylag and the Brent geese. Get a lot of widgeon, get a lot of mallards here throughout the winter, a lot of woodcock, and they've all left. I think they go across to Norway now. And there are one or two puffins going around at the moment, but they're having a bad season. I believe there's not many on the Farne Islands, and we haven't seen many around the shore just now.
And out at sea, I mean, I came up once and I saw dolphins. Do you get dolphins?
We get one or two dolphins going around. It's fascinating when they swim in front of your boat. My father's boat does about 20 knots, and they're darting round and round the bow of the boat. It's a fantastic thing to watch.
And you mentioned deer earlier. I didn't realise there were deer on the island.
Yeah, they've recently come to the island. The seven of them we always see together, so I think that's our population. We've only got seven. But it's fantastic seeing them playing around in the field next door to us every morning.
It's amazing to think they must have come across the sand then.
They must have come across the sand or the causeway, yeah. Probably at night time when there's not many people going around.
At night time?
Yeah.
I wonder how they knew when the tide was going to come.
Exactly, yeah. They must have chanced it right anyways. Yeah. Better than the tourists. They know their stuff.
I've now come to see the Reverend Paul Collins, who's the vicar of St Mary's Parish Church. Do you feel saints like Aidan and Cuthbert offer almost not an alternative view, but a more organic view of what religion may be?
I think they inspire people in that kind of way. They're both very connected with Northumbria and I think the Northumbria coast, men who really understood or sought to understand their context.
One of the things I love about the island is I also feel the presence of the actual maker of the book. I'm a writer, so I feel the presence of Eadfrith. Do people mention Eadfrith at all when they come?
Some of them do, and certainly we try to raise people's awareness of the production of the book and therefore of Eadfrith. And I think certainly this year we'll be trying to do more of that, so that when we have a big pilgrimage here in July, and I think as well as celebrating Cuthbert, who's a kind of excuse for the book, we will also be focusing on the person who commissioned and made it.
Fantastic. So the big pilgrimage that you mentioned, what is that?
Well, it will be for all Christian denominations, and the idea is to celebrate the creativity of the Lindisfarne Gospels and to share in that and to seek to be inspired by that today.
So people will be coming from everywhere?
The invitation is to everywhere, but mainly I think from the northeast.
Yeah.
And I think we've probably already got through about 2,000 tickets.
2,000?
Yes.
Who will all come?